Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. Our speaker is Jim from the Downtown Eastern Group.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jim. I'm an alcoholic. Where were you on the night of March 1st? It's what kind of feels like out there. Very grateful to be here. Very grateful to be sober. Really blessed to be able to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous anywhere at any time. You know, I am in Bucks County, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Bucks County. I have a little history in Bucks County. I made a couple of very good friends here in Bucks County. One guy's name was Isaac Garb, and another one's name was Ken Beam. You know, in hindsight, I'm really grateful for those guys, because those guys made some decisions in my life that I was incapable of making that put me in places that... It's probably one of the reasons why I'm standing here today, because, you know, left to my own devices, you'd probably have a different speaker here today, for real. And, you know, I'm very grateful for what happened in Bucks County, because it's a part of my story, it's a part of my experience. I do have a sobriety date. It is August the 20th of 1998. I do have a home group, and it's a new home group. And you'll hear why it's a new home group a little later in my story. It is the Downtown Eastern Group. My old home group was actually the Dr. Bob Ford Group in Wilkes-Barre, Kingston area, where I still do live, but God has got me doing other things in other places. And in a long conversation with my sponsor told me, you know, you really need to probably have a home group where you have maximum service, and that's been the Downtown Eastern Group recently. So that's kind of how all that changed. You know, it's weird. You know, if I could tell you about some of my first impressions of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll clearly tell you that this is a program that I never wanted to be in. This is, a place I swore I would never wind up in. Because my first impression of Alcoholics Anonymous was not good. My first meeting was in 1978. I did not wind up in that meeting on purpose, I guarantee you that. I was actually in Bucks County Prison, which at that time was in the middle of Doylestown, the old prison, and I was on long line, and it was about 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, and I was propped up in my bunk, watching a little TV, and this guy pops his head in the cell and says, "Hey Jim, there's free donuts and free coffee in the cafeteria." And me being the selfish and self-centered guy I am, if it's free, it's for me. And not only if it's free, it's for me, I have a plan why I'm going there on how free it's going to be and how much free it's going to be. And I get up and I get this plan very quickly in my mind that I could go over there and get as many donuts as I can and as much coffee as I can, and I could leave the cafeteria and go back to my cell, and I could prop myself in my bunk and watch a good movie and just have the best day in jail I've ever had with donut crumbs all over my chest. That was my plan. So I put the jacket on, and I roll over to the cafeteria, and I get in, and sure enough, the donuts and the coffee, just as promised. And I put two in the right pocket, two in the left pocket, one in the hand, great big cup of coffee, and I'm headed to go back to my cell, and I hit the door, and this guy with this uniform. And I'll assure you that there's been plenty of guys with uniforms in my life, as you hear my story. Stops me and says, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to watch a movie. I'm going back to my cell." And he said, "No." And I said, "What do you mean, no?" He says, "You have to stay for the meeting." And I was like, "What meeting?" And he's like, "The AA meeting." And I remember I looked at him and I said, "You know, what's an AA meeting?" And he looked at me as though I had 10 heads, kind of like a lot of people have looked at me in life through my story, and said, "Please go take a seat in the back row. Don't make any noise. It'll be over in an hour, and you can go back to your cell and do whatever you want to do." And I remember, just like on the inside, getting all wound up and angry, and like my plan wasn't working, and I turned around to walk to the seat, and I looked at the guy who told me there was free donuts and coffee, and like I wanted to punch him really bad. You know what I mean? Like, I'll be honest with you. And I sat in the back seat next to him, and these older gentlemen walked into the room, people who may refer to as old timers, and they sat down, and you know, I was like sitting there hoping this thing would have been over like a minute ago, and they began to tell their stories. And I remember turning around and looking at the guy next to me and saying, "What losers. Can't believe you've actually come into a jail and talk about that stuff. I can't believe you got me in this." And I can tell you clearly in hindsight that probably every one of the character defects that have come up in my four-step happened within that hour period in that scene. Beyond a reasonable doubt. I was judgmental, opinionated, you know, you name them all. They were all flying around. And the meeting was finally over, and I thought I was going to get a little relief. And everybody stood up, and they kind of stood here, and all of a sudden, they started to reach their hands out. And I watched people holding other people's hands. And guys don't hold guys' hands in jail. So I had a little problem with that one. And then they began to say the Lord's Prayer, and I didn't know it. For those of you who don't know my full name is actually James Joseph Anthony. I should probably know the Lord's Prayer a little bit, right? You know? So, you know, I walked out of that place and I got back to my cell and I laid there and I thought, wow, never, never, ever again will I step foot in a place like that. Well, I'll clearly tell you, and I'll keep it real short when I tell you, is I've been in a lot of institutions, a lot of detoxes, and a lot of jails. And no matter where I went, the powers of being that were directing my life have always led me back to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could not duck it. I go to rehab. Well, when you get out, you got to go to AA. I'd go to a detox. Well, we're not going to send you rehab, but go to AA. You know, I'd have a probation and a parole officer. You got to go to me. You got to go to AA. So no matter what was happening, you always wanted to send me back to this place that I had the worst experience in the world with. Well, you know, I can tell you that, you know, I've been kicked out of a lot of places. You know, found my stuff in many a lawn. Mom and Dad had a hard conversation with me and said I couldn't be there anymore. Two things that have been a constant in my life. You know, I've never been to jail and they told me I couldn't come in. No room for you tonight, Jim, maybe another day. And I've never been to AA and they told me I had to get out. AA has always had a seat for me, despite how I was doing or what my perception of life was. They always welcomed me, and they always tried to give me the message of hope. Now, I can tell you earlier on, when you had the opinion of AA that I had, there was no hearing any message of hope. You know, I was nowhere close to being done with doing what I was doing. You know, I can tell you that for the longest time, I tried to figure out, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. You know, I was all right with being a criminal. I was all right with being a burglar. And I was like, I had a lot of titles in life, but that alcoholic title, I just wasn't feeling. You know? I wasn't feeling it. Really wasn't. You know? Like, you know, our book talks about the alcoholic with the grandiose behavior and the inferiority complex. You're looking at who they were talking about. My picture should be there. Okay? Because the reality was, is there was a lot of grandiosity in criminal behavior with the people I hung out with, you know? If I robbed a house and got the most out of the house, you know, it was like I was a legend. You know what I mean? When reality was, you know, behind that whole facade that I lived was this scared little boy. This scared little boy that I never wanted to let anybody see. You know, my sponsor always talks to me about that grandiose behavior, and you know, she says, you know, one day she said to me, you know, Jim, how about if we call you King Shit of Poo Poo Island? How's that? You're the top third of the thirds. How's that? Because that's what about, you know, when we go through your story and who you are and your grandiosity, you know, there's really nothing there of claim to fame that you should be talking about, that you want to drag into who you want to be today. You know, you know, you hear a lot of speakers share from the podium about the hole in the soul. You hear a lot of people sharing the podium about the spiritual malady, that disconnection. You know, one of the things I found out when I worked very closely with a sponsor is I felt that way, but I wanted to know where it came from. Where did this feeling come from? Like, poof, you just had it one day? Like, what happened? You know? I was looking for answers. And, you know, when I went back in my four-step and I started to dig up a lot of the fears and a lot of resentments, people like my father popped up on that list real heavy. You know, my father, rest his soul, is dead today. He died of alcoholism. Alcohol was the most important thing in his life. I mean, it was more important than me, my mother, our family situation, any job, anything you can imagine. Alcohol was the most important thing to him. So my life was affected very early from alcoholism. Did I know it was alcoholism? No, I didn't know it was alcoholism. You know, my dad was the kind of guy, you know, who talks in the book about the Jekyll and Hyde. My dad was the classic Jekyll and Hyde with alcoholism. He was the guy in the morning that would put me on his knee, and he would play with me, and he was the best dad in the world. And all of a sudden, he would, like, look at the clock. And he would put me down. Yes, God bless you. He would put me down, and he would get up, and he would walk over, and he would put his jacket on, and he would leave the house, and you would not see him all day, and you would not see him most of the night. And all of a sudden, it'd be somewhere 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night. That door would come flying open much faster than when he left and he closed it. There would be a different man standing in the door. Everything about him had changed. The way he looked, the way he smelled, the way he talked. And I also had this mother who was like 4'7" or 4'8". But she acted like she was 7'6". Italian descent. Thing just went. Like she had a point to prove. You know what I mean? Thing just went, you know? And she didn't do well with my dad's alcoholism either, because he would come home drunk and she would step right up to the door and start telling about himself, and he didn't handle that very well. So he would go into his acting role of, let me start to rearrange the house so she'll shut up. She doesn't shut up though. And then he'd start to rearrange her. And she still wouldn't shut up. So it didn't take me very long as a kid to find a favorite place in my house when my dad would come home, and that was under the bed. That was my little safe hiding place. And I would kind of peep out and I would listen, and I could remember, and I didn't know it then, but I know what it is today. I was so consumed with fear because I didn't know what was going on. Why? And on a good day, the hand would come under the bed and pull me out, and I'd become a part of the scenery. And it was pretty devastating. Yeah? And I can remember right from that moment being probably one of the most confused kids in life. I would step outside into my neighborhood and I would begin to say things to other kids that were a total lie so that they wouldn't know what was going on in my family. Right away, I began at that age to compare my insides with everybody else's outsides. And I began to, me and my father are going to do that. Oh yeah, me and my father are going to do that too. Oh, my family's going here. Oh yeah, my family's going there too. And I would begin to begin this act that we talk about in our big book, long before I ever added alcohol to the picture. The act was on. Because I was more worried about what you thought of me and how you felt about me, because that was do or die in my life. Because there was no longer anything healthy going on in my household. There were no skills being taught, no nurturing going on. Everything was pure devastation from alcoholism. You know? You know, I can remember probably as I got older, the other safest place I found was sports. I was a pretty good athlete. It was a place I could go and I could participate in something where I felt very worthy and I felt a part of, and I felt accomplished. Only problem is you can't play sports all day and night. Sooner or later you have to go home. And when I would go home, it would erase everything that I experienced in the course of that day that felt good. You know? And then one day, because I was a follower, because nobody taught me how to lead, so I followed trying to get you to like me, and one day I ran into some other people like you who had that magic, had that thing that filled that hole. And I remember drinking it. Really didn't know anything about it. Didn't like the taste of it. Actually really didn't like the way it made me feel in the end, but I loved the way it made me feel in the beginning. Because in the beginning there was relief. And I think for myself, as I tell you my story, that you'll see a consistent pattern of, I'm just looking for relief, man. I just don't want to feel the way I'm feeling. You know? And I'm going to any lengths and putting this act on not to feel that way. You know? And, you know, if I'm honest with you about what alcohol did to me from the very beginning, there was a robbery that took place. You know? Alcohol was the vehicle for it. And I was the robber. I robbed myself of a life with alcohol. Because it took from me from the very door. It changed my friends. Changed my education. It changed my relationship with my family. Changed my goals, changed my dreams. It changed absolutely everything about who I was as an individual. And I perceived that none of it was ever a problem. because I didn't know any better. And, you know, I started to experience consequences at a young age, you know, getting arrested, calling mom, have to come to the police station and get me, you know. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous because they're so kind in their words. You know, that first step. They use that word unmanageability. I think unmanageability is very kind. I don't know about you guys. Unmanageable, like, was like in the really, really beginning when, like, I was nabbing a 10 out of mom's wallet, or maybe skipping some school, or maybe not coming home when I was supposed to, or, you know, that was unmanageable. I could clearly tell you that unmanageable lasted about 6 months for me, and then everything became completely devastational. I had my first child at age 15. You know, digging holes. Digging holes is a child that adults have a hard time getting out of, you know. Getting kicked out of two different schools. My mother actually had to pay a Catholic school to push me through school to graduate me. I'm doing things like fighting with the principal in the hallway, punching him, and I'm a violent kid now. I mean, my emotions and who I am as an individual is so out of whack because of alcohol and other things that nobody knows what to do with me. You know, let me be real honest with you about something. In my mind, alcohol could never really take me where I wanted to go. It was like the primer. It was the thing that I did so that I could get to a point to give myself permission to go find it, what else there was out there to take me to whatever level I was trying to get to where I didn't know where I was going to begin with, to be honest with you. But when I did my fourth step and I really sat down and I looked at my history, one of the things I definitely noticed was this. Everything always began with a drink. Everything always ended with a drink. And there was always a drink present through all of it. So alcohol has always been the common thread and major bond of whatever I've done out there in life. My mom took her first dance at age 18, said to me, "Jim, you can no longer be here. You have to go find someplace else to live. We don't trust you. You're violent. You know, just everything about you says you cannot live in this home. We are fearful of you. We cannot live in fear with you in the house." And I didn't have any place to go. And she came up, you know, moms come up with really great ideas when they're struggling and suffering, because my mom had never dealt with issues of alcoholism with my father. And my father had left my life when I was 5 years old, and she remarried. I had a stepdad, and I'm utter chaos. My alcoholism now in the household. And she's coming up with these great plans how to make everything okay, and she doesn't know how to do that. So she came up with this great idea that I should probably go move with the guy I hid under the bed from. That was her brilliant idea. And for a kid at 18 who had no place to go, and by 18 figured out how much his real father loved his alcohol, sounded like a really great idea. And I moved with my father outside of Philadelphia, Bucks County, Bristol, Levittown, down in that area. And, you know, I'd love to tell you we were father and son. I'd be lying to you if I told you that, though. You know, we were drinking buddies, drugging buddies, criminal buddies, violent buddies. Like, we did everything together that you could do to, like, create more of that devastation in life. And eventually, we did time in the same cell together. You know, I can remember back then how cool I thought that was. I'm doing time with my dad, man. Yeah. Wow. You know, I think the insanity in that just in itself, you know. And, you know, all my role models were people that probably drank harder than I did other things harder than I did, had bigger amounts of it, had nicer things from it. You know, they were my role models. And a lot of my role models were doing what I was doing, and that was going to jail. Because I started going in and out of the county system as soon as I moved with my father. And these role models, they began to teach me these habits and lessons. And one of the lessons they taught me at a young age was how to get out of jail and go to rehab. You know, they told me, you know, if you go up and tell them that at 18 that you have a problem and you want to do something about your problem, they're going to send you to a rehab gym. And I was like, get out. Next morning, I'm like, I got problems, man. You know what I mean? Help me out. 3 days later, they're sending me to rehab. I'm like, this stuff works, man. I can't believe it. You know, in hindsight, when you really look at the picture, every one of them could teach me how to get out of jail. None of them could teach me how to stay out of jail. Kind of like the drink. A lot of people helped me put the drink down, but none of them have been able to keep keep the drink down permanently. I had to go through a whole other process for that to happen. And, you know, I went to my first rehab in 1978, a place called Pottstown Area Drug Rehabilitation Program. I went there to get out of jail. One of the old timers told me before I walked out of the jail, make sure you tell them what they want to hear or they'll send you back here. So I went there with a plan that I was going to say absolutely anything I had to say to stay there. Because they did really nice things for you there. Like they let you wear street clothes and fed you real food. And you know, that was like huge for me, you know what I mean? And, you know, and I went there and, you know, they would grill me and I would give them every answer possible until they would ease up off me. And I was in that program probably for about 3 months and eventually they said, you know, Jim, you're graduating, you're done here. And I was like, cool. And I hopped the bus in Pottstown and I headed for Norristown. And I got off that bus in Norristown, hopped the train to Philly, got dropped off in Fishtown, and within 3 hours I was belly up to the bar with my father, drinking like I had never been through none of it. And then got to that point where I primed it enough and then started making phone calls. And I was dead in the middle of the mix as though I've never been locked up or something yet. And three things always happen with me. And I don't know if you guys can identify this, but three things are happening to me when I put a drink in this body. One is, I'm planning to commit a crime. As soon as I drink, I'm planning to do something. Second thing is that I'm committing that crime and the police are after me for committing that crime. So it's guaranteed. And the third thing is that there is no such thing as probation or parole when I drink or drug. I don't show up to appointments. I don't call you. I don't do anything that you say I'm supposed to do. I go right in to catch me if you can. That's what I do. Because when I run hard and I run fast and I run all over the place. And if the moment comes where I get interrupted in it and I gotta take a break for a while, so be it. If it doesn't, I just keep it moving. Keep it moving until it kills me. You know? And, you know, it came close to killing me a few times. You know, at age 20, I was involved in a very bad situation that had to do with dry goods. And the whole thing went down bad, and I wound up discharging a firearm on somebody. And, you know, I told you about those two buddies of mine, Isaac Garb and Kenneth Beam. I always thought they were the only two judges in this county because they were the only two I would ever see. It just seemed like, and it got to the point where they would like know me on a first name basis, and they would shake their heads when they would bring me in the courtroom, and it was ugly, and I was in a lot of trouble for discharging a firearm on somebody. And I remember they took me in front of Isaac Garb, and the DA started to read what happened, and he looked at me and he said, "Jim, tell me what happened." And I told him the truth at first. I was like, "Your Honor, you're not going to believe this." And then everything after that was a lie. So he kind of stopped me half stream and looked at me very serious and said, "You know, Jim, I believe that you believe that you're not responsible for what happened." He goes, "But we're really missing a word here that you need to get introduced to your life that you are totally missing since you've been coming in out of the criminal justice system. And that word is accountability." He said, "So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a period of time and send you somewhere so you can think about that word and what it means in your life." And he proceeded to give me a 7.5 to 15 year sentence in penitentiary at age 20. And, you know, I went to Graterford at just about 20 years old. And I didn't hear a lot of good stories about Graterford, to be honest with you. Didn't hear about a lot of rocket scientists coming out of there or anything like that. You know what I mean? You know, they told me that, you know, the inmates ran to jail, and, you know, your head's got to be on a spindle at all times because you never know what will happen. And I went to that jail. And for the first time in my life, I identified a feeling that was going on with me that I didn't understand. I knew what it was, but I totally didn't understand what it was truly doing to me, and that word was fear. Because I can remember pulling up in a Blue Goose up to the penitentiary, and the walls were so high, and the guards were holding guns in the corners. And I was saying to myself, "Jim, how did you get yourself in this situation? How did you do this to yourself?" And I can remember the fear had was up through my chest, into my neck, and approaching my face, and it was immobilizing me to the point where I just felt like I was so stuck. And I can remember they brought me in, and they put me in a holding tank. And I don't know what it is about people when they have time on their hands. No pun intended. And they're sitting in places, but they get this infinite wisdom to do things that really mean a lot in life. And I'm sitting in holy things, and stuff scratched all over the walls. And I see this one statement, it was like so profound, and I really didn't truly know what it meant at that time, but I really liked the way it sounded, and it said, "Health, wealth, and freedom, to be fully appreciated, must one day be interrupted." And I was like, oh, that sounds so cool. It's like, yeah. And then they took me in to meet this gentleman, and he called me son. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that through my experience of what it was like, there have been many, many times where I've been sent messages that clearly show me that I need to slow down and check myself before I wreck myself. I've always had the incredible ability within my alcoholism to either not see them, act like they weren't for me, or you must be talking to the guy behind me. And I had one in that penitentiary because I sat down and the first question they asked me in the penitentiary is, where do you want me to send your body if you die here? Yeah, I think it's a pretty alarming question for a kid 20 years old, you know? And I was kind of stuck on the question because mom had dealt with enough. I didn't want to be sent home to mom. But where else was I going? You know, I'm the alcoholic that burns every bridge. Every possible person that loves me and cares about me, you are caught in the ripple effect of my alcoholism and you are in pain and suffering, sometimes even worse than I am. And I left that guy's office and knew a couple guys in the penitentiary, and within 4 days of being in the penitentiary, I'm doing exactly in the penitentiary what I was doing on the street. And so I never even got that sign to pay attention. I was in that penitentiary from 1980 to just about 1988. I almost died in that penitentiary. I owed somebody money and you know, I gave them the old promise checks in the mail. And the check wasn't in the mail. And I was in the basement of the penitentiary and three guys appeared out of nowhere. And as you know, I was lying in a pool of blood. And I can remember how hopeless I felt. I can remember sitting there with the blood like in my hands like you see in the movies, and I said to myself, just lay back and die, Jim. You don't have to do this anymore. You don't have to make any calls to your mom and tell her how bad things are going. You don't have to show up in front of any judges anymore. You don't have to do this time they gave you. You don't have to explain to the children you have that you don't take care of and you're not a father in their life, that your dad died independent, or what's going on. You just lay back and die. And I can remember laying back and passing out and woke up in an infirmary with about 80-some stitches in my leg. And a deputy warden asking a lot of questions. Questions like, what happened? And I looked at him and I said, I fell out of my bunk. And he looked at me and said, Jim, you don't have a bunk in the basement. And I said, I know, but that's my story and I'm sticking to it. And he looked at me and said to me, I understand. Now you have something to understand. I'm sending you back to population, and whoever did that to you, I'll guarantee you, will probably kill you in 3 days. So you go deal with that if you don't want to tell me what happened. And that's kind of the position I've always worked myself into in life within my alcoholism, is I always get myself in a position where, regardless of where I turn, there's another major consequence that's about to happen. Always another major consequence that's about to happen. And I went back to the block. I picked up that phone. First person I called wouldn't accept the charges. Second person I called accepted the charges, told me they really couldn't help me. And then I made that third phone call. And we all know who that third phone call was to. Because that's the phone call I always make. And I had to hit her with that news. I remember when I was 17 years old, her telling me in the kitchen with that 7'3" voice, if you ever go to jail, I will never come visit you. I will disown you. I can remember today that no matter wherever I was in jail at or whatever was going on, my mother always came to show me she loved me and was there to support me unconditionally. You know, I remember I was, my mom came into a visiting room one time. She was crying her eyes out. I was like, Mom, I promise I'll never do it again.
swear I'll stop. I'll never do it again. She goes, I hope not. She said, my integrity, my dignity was just taken. I'm like, what happened? She goes, they just strip searched me. And my mother, you know, you see. I think about some of the things with my alcoholism that happened where, you know, not only am I wrecking and killing my life, I am like, I got hostages that just want to love me unconditionally, and I'm making them pay every emotion and price you can imagine in their life. Because all they want to do is have enough hope that maybe it'll be different. They just want it to be different. And you know what? I just want it to be different too, but I don't know how to make it different. Because alcohol is my solution for the longest time to the relief of the fact that I can't live and I can't stand myself in my own skin without it. And then I start using it at such a young age that I don't know how to do anything else. And I get out of that penitentiary and they send me to my second rehab, a place called Eagleville Hospital. Loved it. Cooled up, green grass, looked like a college campus. Girls. I was like, oh, I'm in heaven. Now, I'd seen a few girls in a penitentiary, I'll guarantee you. They were bigger than me. They were missing more teeth than me. And they could fight way better than me. I'll tell you that. So there wasn't nothing appealing about seeing girls in jail, okay? But when I got to Eagle Hospital, they looked real good. And it had been a long time. And we're pulling up the driveway. I don't know what. I don't know why they shackle you up even harder when they take you out of the place than when they bring you in. But I got them around my ankles. I'm all tied up at the waist. And we're pulling up, and I'm seeing these girls, and I'm getting my plan together. I'm getting some. And we pull up, and there's three girls standing underneath this tree, and I look at them, and they're smiling. You can't smile at me when I'm sick, just in case you didn't know, because I will make that into something that you will not believe. I am like, they like me. Right? So then I do my thing where I kind of like, hop out the car. Yeah, we gotta hop out the car. And I'm standing there, I'm trying to wave to them, and I can't get my hand, so I'm kind of going like this, right? And they're smiling even bigger, and I'm like, they're really liking me now, right? And they don't even know it, but I've had sex with each one of them in my mind already, you know what I mean? The whole works, you know? And because that's how delusional I am. That's how delusional I am, man. Even without the drink, I am delusional. And, you know, I know in hindsight today they were probably standing there smiling, saying, will you look at this nut? He can't even get his hand, above his waist. See, you know, that grandiosity that I talked about. I did 6 months in that rehab. And about two weeks left to go, my counselor came to me and said, you know, Jim, it's time for you to go in about 2 weeks. And I can remember, man, I was, like, devastated for the first time. I was in a place where I had ever felt the safest in a long time. I was so safe there. Everything was so nice there. I had to have some hard conversations. I mean, but for an everyday basis of how I lived my life previously, man, it was the nicest place, and I felt the best I ever did in my life. What did I learn about staying sober? Not really too much, to be honest with you. I had a point in my life where I really didn't know a lot about sobriety. I didn't know one thing. I was real tired of being locked up. I was tired of people running my life. I was tired of working for $32 a month. I was tired of showering with guys, 50, 60 guys. You know, I was tired of getting mail and it would be opened and I had no privacy. Because the reality was, is when I drink, when I put a drink to my lips, I lose every piece of me. Because for a lot of years, I wasn't even a human. I was a number, M1636. That's what they referred to me as. Not Jim. Not my last name, M1636. Because that's what happens when I drink and I do other things, is I empower other people to run my life because it becomes way too scary for me to be in control, because not only am I hurting me, I'm hurting everybody else and everything else. Because I have no rules. My drinking has no rules. It is a full-time job with unlimited overtime. And that's the way I'm geared. And you know what? Until I was ready to take a look at that's how I was geared, I would always wind up taking that next drink and getting in that next situation. And my counselor said to me, you know, Jim, maybe you ought to think about not going back to Philadelphia. Maybe you should think about maybe going back to where you're originally from. And I never told you where I was originally from, but where I'm originally from is Eastern Pennsylvania. That's kind of like where it all began. And, you know, I decided to go back to Easton, and they sent me out there with this plan that I told you about earlier.
Go to AA.
I had a higher power at that time. My higher power is called a state parole officer. Okay? He had the power, and I knew it, and he made me aware he had the power. And this is the kind of, this is the way my life goes. I don't know, maybe you can identify with this. I move to Easton, I get my own apartment, my PO comes to see me for the first time, rings the doorbell, I open the door, and I look, and it's the parole officer that I had 9 years ago in Bucks County, in county parole. And he's smiling. And I'm like, no way. And he's like, Jim, I could not believe I got your case on my desk. Because what had happened is he had decided to go to work for the state and came to Allentown as a parole officer and left Bucks County as a county parole officer. And here I am, in his door again, you know. And things were different this time. Things were really different. He said to me, he said, Jim, it's real simple. If you make me do my job, I will. And if I do, you're not going to like how I do it. So why don't you just do what you need to do, and I'll just slowly fade out of the picture. I was like, okay, I think I can do that. That totally fit in that side of I don't want to be locked up anymore. Okay? Now I have this other side, this I need to do something about what's going on with me. And I go to my first meeting in Easton. It was a St. Anthony's meeting. And I remember walking up the steps of the porch. And a lot of people on the porch. And they kind of looked at me and kind of looked at them back. You know, that's what I do with people when I'm not well. I keep you out here. Like, you can't get in. You know why you're getting in here to see who I really am. So I put this act on of like, the hard look, the intimidation, the deep voice, the, like, whatever I have to do. You know, but these people were very welcoming, were very warm, and I totally felt like I could go back there again, and I was happy with that, and I went back. 3 days later, I went for my first job. Why is the front of the application always so much easier to fill out than the back of the application? I'm like 28 years old. I'm like, yeah, Jim Crossing, address, social security number, blah, blah, blah. I flip it over. Please list your previous job history. And at 28 years of age, I don't have one. And I can remember I got that same feeling looking at that application that I got when I was sitting in that blue goose waiting down under the walls of that penitentiary. The fear just right up through. And I remember I took that paper and I ripped it all into pieces. I put it in my hand and I ran out to the car with the person who brought me. And they asked me that question. How'd you make out? And it was a question I lied about. And I said, they said they'd give me a call if something came up. And I remember that ride home was the longest ride home in my mind. Just, I'm up in Disneyland without supervision. You know what I mean? I'm like, I'm never going to be employed. No one will ever hire me. I'm like, I've already got it projected 20 years from now how things just are. My life's going to be in total ruins because of this one job application. And I remember all of a sudden it popped in my mind. I told her, yeah, if you have a problem, go to a meeting and share it. I was like, yes, I can go to the meeting tonight and share it. And I went to the meeting, and the chairperson said, is there anyone? I'm like, yes, me. I have a problem. And I began to whine. Who's ever going to hire me? I'm looking around the room, people are smiling. I'm like, oh, no, you're not laughing at me now, are you? And I'm up there, and I go there. And I'm sitting in my seat, and I'm, like, looking around the meeting, and I'm going, like, you're getting it after the meeting, you're getting it after the meeting. And I'm assassinating the meeting. Like, people don't even know it, but there's, like, bad stuff going to happen to them when we close. Right? They think the end is the Lord's Prayer. They don't even know that's not the end. Okay? Believe me, that is not the end. There's the gym prayer coming up that they don't know anything about. And like with about 5 minutes left of the meeting, this guy gets up and walks over and puts his hand on my shoulder. I turn around, I look at him, and I grit him real hard. He's like, talk to you in the back. And you know, I can. And you guys, you all know this, man. When we're not well, we wear our feelings right on our sleeve. You know what I mean? And people who are well can see we wear our feelings on our sleeve. And he said, this guy talked to you in the back, and he brought me back. He says, I just watched this whole personality change in this meeting since you raised your hand. And like, I can see that you're in the meeting, but not in the meeting. So that tells me you're up here, and I know if you're up here, it's not good. And he said, I want to ask you a couple questions. And he said, well, I said, what? He goes, are you talking to your family right now? I said, yeah. He said, you have a place to stay tonight? I said, yeah. He said, did you eat today? I said, yeah. He says, do you have any money in your pocket? I said, yeah. He said, did you drink today? I said, no. And he looked at me with this most peaceful and serene face and said to me, all you got's a little job problem. And believe me, that really showed me a lot about what I knew about life and where I was at in that period of time at 28 years of age. So I was embarked on this journey of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was back in 1987 or 88. And as I told you, my sobriety date is actually in 1998, which tells you there was a little something going on there. And, you know, our 12 and 12 talks about two-stepping. And that's probably the simplest way of telling you what happened in my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous in that period of time. Because did I know I was alcoholic? I didn't know I was alcoholic. The guessing game was over. You know what I mean? I had correlated that everything that happened in my life. I had everything to do with when I put a drink to my lips. Now that I know that, how can I help you? What can I do for you to make your life better? How can I possibly put my hands into your life and come out smelling like a rose and be all grandiose about how much I really helped you? Why I'm not helping myself whatsoever. And, you know, that higher power worked for the first 7 years. That state parole officer worked. Because I knew he was coming and, you know, I needed to be clean and I needed to be doing the right thing. Otherwise, because state parole, they pull your street time. And I wasn't about to have him pull my street time and add it to my sentence. So I was like, I really got to do this. But then my higher power kind of disappeared. And then I started to, like, kind of disappear out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had, like, put this kind of, like, life together. You know, be careful what you ask for. You just might get it. And one day I said to God, you know, I'd really like to have my son, man, to be a father to him. Bang, he's at my house. I'm like, what do I do now? Holy shit, I got to take care of him. You know, and people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous helped to the best of their ability with keeping my life manageable and how unmanageable I was just taking care of him. Did I see it that way? No. No, I did not see it that way. Because at that point, I was still so selfish and self-centered to the core that I would take anybody and anything and take it hostage at some level to try to manage my life. Because left to my own devices, I really didn't have to do too much. And when I don't know how to do too much, that means I don't like how I feel. And when I don't like how I feel, that means I need relief. And that means when I need relief, I go back to the drink. And I walked away from AA at probably about 7 years of attending meetings and two-stepping, and I found a bigger problem with something than I did with alcohol. I found a problem with AA. And I can tell you, if you want to have a really big problem, find a problem with AA when it's your solution. And I used to have this supermarket down the street from my house, and I swear it was an AA supermarket. I would go there, people from AA would be all over the supermarket. And I would be, you talk about ducking and dodging the supermarket, that's pretty sad, man. I think about it, I'm like, down this aisle, down that aisle. And it's like they had this radar, man. They knew I was there, they would come find me. Hi, Jim, how are you? And they would ask you those two questions. How you doing and where you been? Ones you absolutely had to lie about. And I'm like, I'm doing great, and I've been busy. Yeah. And they would say that third thing that would make me want to punch them. Give me a call sometime, I'll take you to a meeting. Used to drive me nuts. Because I was too busy trying to prove to AA that I really didn't need you guys. That I was going to, like, do this thing. Whatever it was I was doing. Because when I'm out of my mind, I never know what I'm doing. But I was going to do this thing. I was going to show you guys that, listen, there is another way. And eventually when I operate underneath those circumstances, I always put myself in a position where it's me and a drink. And I always lose that battle, because the drink always wins, because it always has. And without a defense against the first one, I'm drinking it. And I did. And basically, if I want to give you the simplicity of the story, is the exact same thing happened to me at 38 years of age that happened to me at 18 years of age. Okay. Put it to my lips, jobs going, kids back to the mother, not talking to my family, back doing criminal, running illegal stuff all over the place. You know, I'm back. Within 6 months, I'm in the mix like I never skipped a beat.
And eventually I wind up back in jail. And my experience in jail was a little bit different this time. You know, I used to call my lawyer like on a weekly basis and tell him, you either need to give me a quick date and get me back to the penitentiary, or you need to get me out of here because I'm going to kill one of these kids. Because they would walk around and call me names like Pops, Old Head. I was resenting it bad, man, right? I was going to kill one of them. I really was. Let me tell you something, what I've learned in hindsight through some step work. The thing I was really resentful about the most when I looked at them was I seen the old me. That's what I resented. I resented seeing where I used to be, and that it made me reflect of everything that happened. And that's what really bothered me. Because I was suffering these two feelings. Guilt and shame. And they were overpowering. And I was in that jail for about a month, and they let me go to my first AA meeting, and I walked down to the AA meeting, and who's chairing the meeting but a guy I sponsored for 7 years. Yeah. And I walked inside the gate, and he had his head down, he was doing something, and I was like, oh, I'm going to make my great escape, get back to the cell, turn around, guy in uniform. I'm like, oh, there's another guy in uniform, right?
Can't get past these guys in uniform, right?
And I turn back around, I look, and he's looking at me, and he's smiling from ear to ear. And it was about an 8-step walk from me to him, and I didn't move. He started walking towards me, and I'm going to tell you the tape that played my mind in those 8 steps. He was going to say to me, Jim, what the heck are you doing? You're such a loser, man. I can't believe you threw everything you had away. You've been hurting the people you've been hurting. You know, I played this tape because this is the tape I play to myself. So of course I think he's going to say it to me. And he comes over to me and he gives me a big hug. And he whispers some really huge words in my ear. And he says to me, I am really glad to see that God has decided to sit you down and have a little talk with you. And I was like, wow. And I went back to my cell that night, and I laid in my bunk. And for the first time, I felt that mustard seed of hope. Because somebody had shared their hope with me, and it changed my perspective about what was going on in my life. Because for the first time, I felt like wasn't happening to me, it was happening for me. And I was sitting dead in the beginning of the miracle. See, because a lot of times, the beginning of the miracle isn't always pleasurable. For me, the beginning of the miracle is being stripped naked of everything and having nowhere else to turn but to something greater than me. For whatever reason. Whether it be foxhole, whether it be begging, whether it be... just as long as there's another opportunity for me to make another move, I'm not going there. I'm going there. So when I'm stripped naked of everything and I'm left with myself, by myself, and nothing's happening, I begin to beg. And I begin to ask for things and say things that I've never been in my vocabulary when I'm out there. And I'm saying and I'm asking those things. And one day, the lady shows up in my cell and gets me into another rehab. And that rehab, I was there 28 days and I was getting ready to leave. And I believe this was the infinite decision that has allowed me to stand before you today. My counselor looked at me and said, Jim, you leave next week, where are you going? And I looked at her and I said, and I don't know where this came from, but this is what I said to her. I said, well, I am totally incapable of making that decision. I have no business making that decision. I've always made decisions like that, and I've always wind up in jails and institutions and places like this. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to turn that decision-making process over to you, and you can direct me on where I need to go. Because I am too fearful that if I make another decision right now, I may not ever make it back to a place like this. And she looked at me and said, you're getting it. And since then, my life has been handed off from person to person that God has put in my life that have really taught me about what it means to stand before you and carry the message of hope. You know, and I've heard other speakers share this, and I feel the same way. You know, thank God for alcohol, because without alcohol, I would have never found these rooms. And thank God for these rooms, because without these rooms, I would have never found a sponsor I have today. And thank God for the sponsor, because without that sponsor, I never really found out what that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous was really about. And thank God for that book, because without that book, I would never be able to walk the man I am today with some integrity and some dignity and some perspective in life and understand that it really isn't all about me. It's really about how I can be in service to life, not only in Alcoholics Anonymous, but in life, in community, how I can be a good employee to my employer,
There were things that were getting in the way of that that I needed to work on. One was I needed to deal with all those fears that immobilized me. I needed to sit down with the sponsor and work on those resentments. My sexual inventory. I needed to sit down and I needed to put my life as an open book. And I needed to take a look at all those character defects. You know. And I said to my sponsor, you know, I've been hearing about these character defects for years. What is a character defect? Where did I get it? Why do I have it? Who implanted it in me? I didn't ask for it. My sponsor took me to the sixth step in the 12-12. He showed me very clearly what a character defect is. And that is not only was I born with the final belief of right or wrong and with something greater than me inside myself, I was also born with something called God-given desires that are very naturally had in life. The only problem is when I begin to blindly use them for self-satisfaction, they become defects of character and fuels my selfishness. And my selfishness is the root of why I stay sick and disconnected. Because my fear and resentments run the show. I have no trust. I don't believe in anything intangible. The reality is if it's not tangible, I don't believe it. I would have stuff right in my hand and wouldn't believe it was the stuff. So now you're asking me to take a third step and believe in something that's not tangible. And it totally bucks against who I am as an individual. But without taking that step, I'll be drunk again and maybe dead. So I embark on that journey. And I begin to do that work. And these promises start to control my life. Because I do start to experience a new freedom and happiness. I don't regret my past or wish to shut the door on it. For those of you who don't know what I do today, I actually work in the field. I work with adolescents. I work with kids in the juvenile justice system. I still get to look at the old me every day. That's what I do for a living. I now work with the people who used to send me away and then present my case. I work with judges and DAs, and that's what I do for a living. So God has truly blessed me. He has taken those natural desires that I took and used for liabilities in my life and now allows me to use as an asset in my life. He allows me to be of use. What a beautiful thing. I usually tell this story when I speak because this was another story that really changed my life. And if you heard it, I'm sorry. Because a lot of stuff that you'll hear me share from the podium outside of my experience, you know, I get from hearing other great speakers really talk about, you know, some of the things they picked up in any way. And we share them with each other. And I use some of them and you know, just... It changed my life. And I was sitting in a meeting at like 4 months sober. And this guy began to talk about his life, about how he had this 9-year-old son and his wife had died of cancer. And I'm like, yeah, I had a 9-year-old son. I raised him myself. So there's a little identifying going on there. And then he started talking about how every day he would like wake up and get his kid ready, take him to school. He'd go to work all day. His mother would pick the child up. And then when he got to work, he would pick the child up. He would come home. And he would make him dinner, he would do his homework, and it would be like 8 o'clock, the guy would be so exhausted. And his son wanted to play every night with him, and he would just didn't have the energy, man. He was like burning himself. He was burning himself out from just taking care of this kid and trying to do the right thing in life. And, you know, this was a pattern that developed in life. And one night he was on the couch, and he was trying to sleep, and the kid came to him after the third time and said, Dad, will you play with me? And he said, he keeps telling him, come back in 20 minutes. And one night he comes to him and he tells the kid, come back in 20 minutes. And he's laying there so frustrated, he sits up and he sees a magazine on the table. And he picks the magazine up and he's trudging through it. He's so angry. He's like, he doesn't have any energy to really move and play with his kid. But he can't sleep now because the guilt's driving him crazy. And all of a sudden he runs into this picture. And it's a picture of a world. And he rips it out. He gets his play and he rips it in all little pieces. And he waits for the kid to come back. And the kid comes back 20 minutes to the tee and he says, will you play with me? And he pops up and he says, I want to make you a deal. And the kid is so excited he didn't hear him come back in 20 minutes. He says, what is it? He says, I want you to put this puzzle together in the other room. When you put it together, it's going to make a picture of a world. When you bring it back to me in one piece, we'll play. And the kid skips off into the other room, so happy.
And the father leans back and says to himself, I will find him sleeping in that paper later. There is no way he's putting that together. And he lays back and he begins to fall asleep, and like he gets in like that first REM, and he feels a tap on his arm. And he's scared to open his eyes. He's like, no, there's no way. And he kind of peeps it over a little bit, and the kid's standing there holding it one piece. And he sits up, and his son's like, Dad, you promised if I got it done, you would play with me. And he said, I will play with you. I just need to know one thing. How did you do that? And he said, well, I went in the other room, and I put all the pieces on the floor, and I was having a hard time getting it together, and I actually quit like three times, but I sat against the wall, looked at the paper, and said, I want to play more, and I want to quit. So I went over, and I came up with this idea that I would start to flip some of the pieces over, and when I was flipping them over, they started to go together. And the next thing you know, I got the whole picture together. He said, when the picture came together, it was a picture of a man. His dad goes, wow, that's really cool. He goes, now, you know what's really cool, Dad? He says, what I found out is once I put the man together, then the world came together. Oh. That's my story right there, right? That's my story. I truly went back with that story and told somebody, and they said to me, Jim, you're ready to do the work now. Because I had totally, for the first time, understood that what I was looking for, I wasn't going to find out there. It was in here. And I needed to clean house. And I needed to become okay with me and let God do what he does out here, and it would fall right into place. And not only would I understand it, I would accept it. I would have the right perception of it. And the bottom line is, I would use it in his work to help other people. Because the bottom line of why I'm really standing here today isn't about me, it's about being of service to AA, to my community. It's about doing God's work. And I am truly blessed to do this. Thank you very much.